Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Florida Housing Third Workshop for 2020 to 2021 RFAs. My name is Wanda and I am your event manager. During the presentation, your lines will remain on listen only. If you require assistance at any time, please press *0 on your telephone and the coordinator will be happy to assist you. I would like to advise all parties that this conference is being recorded. And with that, I would like to hand over to Marissa Battle. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. Welcome everyone to our third large general RFA cycle workshop. It's really weird. None of us are in the same room, so we're not all sitting at Florida Housing. We're all in our various remote locations, as you all are as well. So we are excited that so many of you are still joining us. So we're going to do introductions for those of us who will be on the speaker line today. And then we will jump into the agenda. So I'm going to hand it over to our Executive Director, Trey Price.
Thanks, Marissa. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us here at this workshop. Want to thank everybody for their participation as well as your feedback. I receive and read every one of the letters, emails that you all send in regards to your comments. And appreciate those very much, and those go around to a number of us here at Florida Housing. And again, very much appreciate the comments and feedback that we're getting, and that helps us as we craft our funding proposals for the next cycle. So thank you very much for those. Thanks for attending today, and we look forward to working with you in this next cycle moving ahead. Thanks so much. I'll turn it back over to the operator.
Actually, I'll jump in there, Trey. Kevin, did you want to mention anything?
Oh, yeah, that's Kevin Tatro. Appreciate everyone being online here and the robust number of calls in and all the feedback we're getting. And looking forward to talking with anybody, you know, after this if need be, too. So thank you.
And I'm Jean Salmonson. I'm also on the call. I'm one of the assistant directors in the multifamily department. I help work on writing the RFAs. And thank you very much.
Well, that's all of us who will, for the most part, be on the speaker lines here for Florida Housing. And so the way that this is, the workshop is going to work is like we have done all of them previously. We're just going to go through the agenda, which we know most, hopefully all of you have been able to receive because we're getting public comments to it. So that's great. So that's on our website. We'll stop periodically for comments or questions, and we may, depending on how the flow of all of this goes, you know, we think there'll be about two hours of content, but if it seems like we're extending on a little longer, we may take a break at some point. And if we do so, we just encourage you to go on mute. Don't hang up from the call and then try to call back in. But we'll see how all of that goes. We just want to make sure that we get enough time to talk about everything that you all want to talk about and hit all the high points. Another housekeeping item I'll mention is that we have, as Trey said and Kevin said, we have received a tremendous amount, even in the last 24 to 48 hours of public comments that we're working to get up on our website and really take the time to digest. And so we will be doing that. And some of those we have been able to look at. We may draw those into the discussion points on the agenda itself as well. But just because we haven't mentioned your issue doesn't mean we haven't seen it. You know, we're still continuing to analyze everything. And so while we won't have another large workshop like this, you know, we may continue to put out additional guidance before we get into the RFA cycle itself. And And that's the only other thing I'd say in terms of the interaction and communication when we open up the phone lines is just to be mindful of time as well that we've got today to go through things. So we're just going to jump right in and email if you're having a hard time hearing or if you're getting any feedback, please. Let one of us know, but hopefully we're going to be able to continue forward with no technological issues either. So the first page of the agenda, we've gone over the overview. We do have an RFA timeline that is on the website. It's the draft for 2020-2021. Now, what you all also know is that after this agenda was noticed and put online, we've had to postpone our board meeting that was previously scheduled for yesterday. And so in that board package, there's also a copy, just for informational purposes, for the board of directors with the timeline and the tentative funding amounts that we'll be looking at for the next RFA cycle. So if you haven't seen that, please take a look at that. The dates will start to gel up more once we have an understanding of, what our future board meetings are going to look like and things like that. So check out the RFA timeline. And we'll just really jump into the meat of it here on page one with item three, ability to proceed. So the disclaimer of this, this information here, which has been the subject of a lot of feedback we've received in public comment is that, when we talked about at the last RFA workshop, if you joined us, we indicated that we do have the corporation has an interest overall in getting to funding developments that are more shovel ready and have demonstrated a greater or more efficient ability to proceed going forward if they're awarded funding. And we felt like we talked about that sort of tentatively. We talked about and put some questions out there to you all as stakeholders of, should we ask for some form of site plan approval? Should we ask for perhaps environmental approval and some items like that? And we felt like we got a lot of positive feedback, which was, yes, Florida Housing, go forth. This is the right thing to do, and we should fund developments that are that ready to go. And then we committed it to paper, kind of based on what we thought we'd heard, and tried to formulate something and with an approach that looked to the way we used to ask for some of these requirements a few years back. And I can definitely say we've heard folks loud and clear that that people feel like this maybe the pendulum is swinging too far to provide points the way we have put in the agenda that may create difficulty for some potential developments for various purposes, be it that local governments work differently depending on where your proposed development is situated, depending on the cost and expense, which we don't take lightly, but also that is a part of why we were trying to nail down some items that required the demonstration of a little bit more skin in the game, for lack of a better way of putting it, than what we feel like we've required previously. And then there is also the big unknown, which is how potentially how the impacts of the pandemic will trickle down to local governments processing certain approvals and meetings and things like that, which we haven't heard a lot of, but we do know that we've got to be mindful of any impacts that may have. And so so with that in mind, I think we're willing to entertain looking at these approaches in a different way, at least some of them in any event. So, we're still going to have our new ability to proceed forms that we've traditionally had, and we're willing to look at, backing away from something as strict or straightforward as that ultimate site plan approval getting 5 points. We're willing to hear more feedback. So we really haven't heard much. We have had some, but much about the concerns with the environmental forms. And so this is really intended to be a back and forth. So if not this, our question is, then what? I know that, you know, we can look at some of the RFAs a little bit differently. For example, Miami-Dade, that's a captive county, while there are some, you know, there are some other local government aspects to approvals and such in that county. We may be able to tailor things differently to the Miami-Dade RFA as opposed to the small-medium RFA. Some of the feedback that we've received, which is, well, if you're going to do priority designation, that really takes care of this whole problem. If what you were trying to fix here was, getting down to, a minimal number of a smaller pool of applicants, and that may have that effect, but ultimately we really do want to have applications that are coming in the door that aren't ultimately needing as many extensions once they get in the process. And so so that's the feedback that we're looking for with those. And before I open up the line for comments about those point values, I want to also touch on within that section subpart D, we talked about the applications in the same vein, applications that would include a deed or an executed lease with a local government for at least 50 years, which is the traditional RFA requirement, would receive extra points. And that was provided in the same vein. I understand site control is in some ways a little bit different than some of the other approvals required, and provides different that provides different inherently different opportunities and challenges depending on the way that, you know, if you're a developer, your business model works. The thought process was to say, in those circumstances, we're not dealing with the unknowns of, you know, purchase agreements, and we're not dealing with the unknowns of digging through all of these potentially at times problematic assignments and various items that go along with the eligible contract component of site control. But we have heard some folks loud and clear about the challenges with what we have, what that represents as well. So we're interested in any feedback about that. If folks just are happy to rely on the comments they've submitted up until this point, then that's fine too. But at this point, I'd open up the lines for any comments or questions. And operator, can you let folks know how to get in the queue as well for that?
Yes, of course. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone. If you then decide to withdraw your question, simply press star 2. And actually, we have two upcoming questions. The first one is coming from Ryan Waterfield. Please go ahead.
Hi, Marissa. This is Brian Waterfield with Tim Shell Development Group. I hope you're doing well. I have submitted a comment or two, and I haven't had a chance to review all of the other comments, so I apologize if a lot of this is regurgitation, but given that I'm the first one going, maybe it will take care of some of the other comments. But the first comment that I have is around the 5 points for the site plan approval, which you just talked about. We believe that awarding points for final site plan approval will essentially be like points for advanced review, and that there will really be no purpose in submitting an application if you do not have final site plan approval. And we completely understand that requiring final site plan approval by the jurisdiction should promote more shovel-ready sites and prevent extensions of corporation-designated deadlines and things like that. However, we do anticipate that there will be many unintended consequences to requiring final site plan approval. The first one is just the cost overall. This requirement will significantly add to the upfront costs incurred by developers prior to submitting an application. The additional expense could vary between municipalities, but could be upwards of $50,000 to $100,000 in some cases. I think a final site plan approval prior to application would make a lot more sense in a state like Georgia, where developers have a good idea of whether or not their application will be funded based on their application's total points. However, under a lottery system, there will be a tremendous amount of wasted expense. Just assuming $75,000 per site plan approval, 50 total applications, and 10 applications being funded in the medium-small geo, that would equate to roughly $3 million of wasted expense on site plan approvals. The second concern that I have is that the requirements for the site plan approval will vary so greatly between municipalities, and we think that a lot of developers will probably steer clear of the municipalities with more stringent and costly requirements. And we also believe that this will push more development toward more rural and less populated areas in the state and away from more urban and greater populated areas. I have just two more, and like I said, hopefully this will take care of the other comments as well. But the third one is the anticipated release date of the median small geo RFA is in August, and it's anticipated the applications will be due in November. 3 months is a very small amount of time to get final site plan approval as it is, but it has become even a smaller window in the current conditions caused by the pandemic. And finally, we believe that this requirement will open the door for more litigation to interpret if final site plan approval was actually achieved or if the requirements were actually met. We do believe that the additional developer experience points that you're proposing is a good idea, and awarding developers 15 points for not having any housing credit exchanges or more than one second extension to corporation deadlines will ensure that the corporation is working with developers who historically have avoided unnecessary delays. If you will require some kind of site plan approval, we would encourage you to return to the 2017 status of site plan approval process, where the jurisdiction has the option of selecting that either a final site plan has been approved or a preliminary or conceptual site plan has been approved or reviewed. Thanks, Marissa.
Thanks a lot, Brian. And before we go on to the next comment in the queue, I just wanted to you brought up something that I intended to and had not, which is and we'll talk about a little later, which is that I think the corporation does recognize that implementing something with regard to consequences for what is currently in the development pipeline. I think we do recognize what you're saying. Like that may be enough for us to be able to hone in on some things. So I appreciate you bringing that up. But we'll go to the next caller in the queue.
The next one is Francisco Rojo. Please proceed.
Good morning. This is Francisco from Landmark. Yes, I think I've sent a public comment on elements of this, and my comments were mostly related to the issue of site control. And what I would say is, as in hearing Marissa, what you're saying, and my understanding from prior comments, is that the corporation is really looking your end goal, and a lot of the goals behind these ability to proceed changes or this prospective changes are related to just making sure projects do not request extensions when they get awarded. And I think the corporation has already taken a really good step with regards to the 15-point award or 15-point penalty, whatever we want to call it, related to not asking for extensions. And I think that is just like you have done with regards to the idea of if we award you and you don't move forward, you're going to get a timeout. You are instituting a timeout with regards to extensions that I think is going to be very strong. And I think outside of that move, the other moves are really not necessary. So that is a very powerful weapon that you're using, and I think it's a good move. But what I would do is really I would stay away from combining all the other elements, because I think that's going to be I think it's the wrong set of orientation with regards to the development community, in particular as it relates to site control. The idea that we would say, hey, if you own this property, you're going to get more points, or if you have a ground lease, you're going to have more points, I just don't see how that relates to the quality of the development. And so I would say in that regard, I would really suggest that you stay away from that item. That's what I have.
Thank you, Francisco. Appreciate the comments. Do we have more folks in the queue, operator?
Yes, we have three. The next one is coming from Chris Bryant. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Marissa, everybody. Chris Bryant with the Ortel Law Firm. My comment is about the ability to proceed form dealing with roads availability. An issue came up in some recent litigation about who's the appropriate entity to sign that form. And this was a situation where you had a development that was located within the city limits of a city, but it fronted on a road that was designated as a county road. And there was a dispute about whether the city should sign that form or a representative of the county. There seems to be a disconnect within the RFA internally in terms of if you used the form, there may be some ambiguity. If instead you submitted a letter from the local government, it was clear that the letter should come from the local government within which the development is located, which I think is the better approach. Roads are unlike water, sewer, and electricity, where there's a service being delivered to the site on an ongoing basis. Roads are roads. They're built, they're there. I'll submit a written comment on that, but I think it should be clarified. The form should indicate that it should be signed by a representative of the local government within which the development site is located.
Thanks, Chris. And I can tell you, we'll look forward to your written comment, and it has been a subject of discussion here. So we have not forgotten that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
The next one is coming from Chris Shear. Please go ahead.
Hi, Marissa. Good morning. First, just wanted to thank you guys for continuing to make and consider changes that improve this process and ultimately fund higher quality development. I said in a written comment, I don't believe it's been posted yet, but I've been talking to a number of developers, and I think a lot of the issues with the ability to proceed site plan point is that there's a big disparity between jurisdictions and the ability to secure whatever the corporation defines as final site plan approval. An alternative that I threw out there really for thought and consideration is, and keeping in mind, the goal is to fund developments that can demonstrate a higher level of due diligence being performed, ultimately resulting in ability to proceed, more shovel readiness, less extensions, et cetera. An alternative that I'd like input on from other developers and from the corporation to consider is a little bit of a hybrid in terms of demonstrating the due diligence has been performed through providing a detailed site plan within the application itself. Exactly what that site plan will entail, I think, is up for discussion, but the idea would be to have a site plan that effectively shows that the due diligence is performed at the same level that a site plan submission to a municipality would have performed, and that secondarily, to have a licensed engineer provide verification that particular site plan, all of the governing ordinances and codes that it would need to be able to ultimately secure that site development permit, and that the site is overall viable. And I think the idea was that we could take out corporation from being responsible for being site plans and having to opine on the validity of a site plan or a particular component of it, and putting that accountability onto a professional engineer who is perfectly qualified to do that. And that allows developers who don't have the time to go through a lengthy process, but are willing to make the investment in it development site to a point, I think, else we don't before came as a site plan permit that same level of detail will be diligence performed, but ultimately have taken the time, which does take and varies, to go through an actual or DRC, City Commission, what has to approve. So just wanted to get that idea out there. I like the idea of continuing to find ways to fund development that are shovel-ready, and I think it will ultimately help to limit the number of applications that are submitted. Naturally, you're not going to have the capacity to do 39 medium county detailed site plans. As you know, there's been a number of developers who submit applications at a level that this would be safe to do so. So something I wanted to get out there. There's a comment posted, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thanks, Chris. Yes, for those comments that have come in within the last sort of 72 hours or so, they will be, we have received them. They are in the process of getting uploaded on the website. So don't think because they're not there, we haven't looked at them or we've overlooked them. You will be seeing them up there. And I think, you know, what you mentioned is really, that's really an interesting concept for us to think about. You hit on something that, you know, the corporation, of course, if we looked at that type of approach, wouldn't be responsible for, scoring or looking at or opining on the substance of any of those type of requirements. It really is you've gone through the motions to achieve that, and that action in and of itself is meaningful. So I do think that we would be interested in talking about that more if we move away from the hard and fast options that we put in the current agenda. What I'm going to do is we're going to take the next caller, and then we're going to move forward on the agenda so we continue to hit some of these other items. And I'm putting an asterisk about this as some of you out there are able to sort of think about what Chris has mentioned. And there have been some comments we've received that are in that same vein as well. Other types of due diligence materials, which is really what we do want that feedback on. So we'll take one more caller on this issue, and then we will come back to this particular issue at the end if we have more time. So, operator, we'll do the next individual in line.
The next one is Sheen Wilson. Please go ahead.
Sean Wilson. I will defer my comment in order to continue with the agenda. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you. All right. And then so I will commit to coming back to this at the end because I know we could talk about this a really long time. So if you're in the queue, hold on about this particular issue and we'll come back. The next item is the advanced review process. I'm going to hand it over to Jean to talk about that.
Thank you, Marissa. So these are three paragraphs, and we started talking about this in March. The first paragraph especially, we brought that up in March. The third paragraph, I wanted to really stress that this applies to people who already have an approved form that you are going to resubmit. It's still current. So obviously, if you have a form that's already been approved, it was also received more than 2 weeks prior to the application deadline, so you'll still get the 5 points. So really, the new language in the RFAs will combine these two paragraphs to say something like 5 points will be awarded if the principal disclosure form is 1, approved by the corporation at least 2 weeks prior to the application deadline, or 2, received by the corporation at least 2 weeks prior to the application deadline and stamped approved prior to the application deadline. So the second paragraph it explains how we're going to do this receive date because this is new. And I kind of want to read this. I want to stress certain sentences to make sure we all are looking at this the same way. So to document these dates, the corporation will stamp the principal disclosure form on the date they are received and the date they are approved. I really want to stress these next two sentences. If a principal disclosure form has been approved, but the applicant must change the form for any reason, the form may be edited and resubmitted for approval, but the form will receive a new stamp reflecting the date the corporation received that revised form. Likewise, if a form is returned to the applicant for correction, the applicant may make corrections and resubmit the form, but the date of the resubmission will reflect the date received. And then, of course, if the principal disclosure form is submitted for an RFA with a received date that's within 2 weeks of the application deadline for the RFA, the applicant will not be eligible for the 5 advance review points. So, and again, that third paragraph explains that if you have that approved form and it's still current, you can resubmit and still get your 5 points. No, it is not necessary to resubmit just to get a received date. If you already have one that's been approved, you're good. Thank you, Marissa.
Thanks, Jean. Appreciate that. And we're going to move on because we haven't received a lot of questions or concern about the advanced review process changes. It's just a function of, you know, something we're going to need to do. And so the other thing that I wanted to mention high level that's not on this agenda that we've mentioned in previous either in the December RFA workshop or the March RFA workshop that we didn't want to use more paper in saying again is that we will also be looking at giving points for bookmarking submitted applications. And so this goes to the application submission process. And when I say bookmarking, that means that within the PDF that you have for all of your documents, Adobe allows you to would allow you to PDF the different attachments. So when we pull it up, the corporation can easily get to each section. And so we're still talking about doing that. The other item that we're looking at is something that has transitioned during the time period of the pandemic, which we've had a few RFA submission deadlines occur during this time period, and any of you who have been participating in the past few months in those RFAs know that we also transitioned to the ability to wire application fees. And so we will likely be talking about how we implement that with our larger RFAs as well. So that's just something if you were curious. And what that means is that potentially we truly do become a paperless application submission process. So stay tuned about that. Again, something old, something new. The next part of the agenda is, you know, right there with the ability to proceed items, we've received a ton of public feedback on, and we want to make sure we dedicate some time in talking about this and to this. And we were getting feedback about this before we came out with the agenda, so I anticipate there were a lot of you out there that maybe got the agenda and thought, wow, they listened to what we suggested. And so, because we did and we're trying to. So related applications, this is in respect to the RFAs where we would be requiring the designation, that is, of priority one or priority two applications, which for your refresher, you know, we came out and implemented a version of this in the Miami-Dade 9% RFA this past funding cycle. Had some challenges in implementing that the way that we envisioned, and now we're coming back with your feedback as stakeholders and some of our research diligence and experience with how we'd like to implement this requirement going forward. And so some of this is a subject for discussion, but overall, you know, we with regard to definitely the Miami-Dade RFA, we're looking at allowing a maximum of 3 Priority 1 related applications. We've said, of course, that for small, medium, geographic 9% RFA as well. We want to implement this, but we recognize that number, we're willing to take feedback on maybe the number is more than 3. We have different goals and different amounts of applications that are funded in that RFA. I frankly don't see a circumstance where we would say, yeah, 10 priority applications, because there might be 10 applications funded in that one. I don't think that that's, we would not go that far, but I think it's reasonable to increase the number of above 3 for that RFA potentially. So what we've got here is some proposed definitions that will be used in how we define and analyze what a related application is. And I don't want to read all of this verbatim, but you'll see you've got the related application definition there that has terms within it that are further defined below in A, B, and C. So again, taking public feedback, looking at what our, you know, the HFAs in other states do to get at this issue is where we've derived what we think is at least the beginning of a good place for us to go in implementation. Some of the additional things we've discussed that you don't see here are that we will definitely be beefing up the applicant certification and acknowledgement form to also reflect that there, at the very least, there are no side agreements related to any type of partnerships, what have you, or relationships in an application. So we'll be looking at beefing up that language and the consequences of violating that requirement of the RFA. And fundamentally, we'll also be looking at, you know, the way that we phrase this and how we talk about it in these two RFAs are that, you know, the corporation has the discretion to look to all these things and what they what they know about the applications and scoring and reviewing the submissions for priority one and priority two. And then we've received some good feedback about some other other aspects of the relationships between either, you know, related parties or any principals or affiliates or, you know, indirect beneficiaries of applications. So, you know, who's working on behalf of the application itself and how we drill down on that a little more. So we are looking at fleshing that out more. One thing that we also want to make sure as we move forward this and to implement this is that we're not if there are naturally occurring relationships or affiliations between individuals, and this is particularly related to that, quote, related parties or related parties definition, if there are, you know, familial relationships that historically have been separate separate business entities and for a long time, I think we can take a look at how we make sure we're not scooping up some things within this definition that historically have not been a problem and that we're getting at what we perceive to be the issue here. So, and I don't know exactly what that is, but we'll also be looking at how other states look at that as well, too. So that was a lot. Again, hopefully you've had an opportunity to look at this and can understand, you know, where we've are attempting to evolve here. And, you know, what we're holding ourselves is to making it a requirement that gives us more powers, the corporation, to act on any violation of it. And so that's really the intent here. It's not to have this here and then not be able to do anything about it going forward. We want to be able to do something about it. But if there's a violation of what our requirements are, but more importantly, that it's just abided by, that everybody understands, and we're all playing off of the same, the same sheet of music, RFA, what have you. So that's a little bit more of the background about this. And with that, I will, operator, if you could open up the line for any folks in the queue for comments. And I would say specifically to this this subject matter in the agenda. Again, if you've got something related to and you were waiting in line on the other stuff, like, we will come back to that at the end. I want to make sure we spend some time talking about this. Thank you.
So just a quick reminder, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1. And we have an upcoming line. It's from Rodrigo Paredes. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Actually, I was on the queue for, you know, the first segment of the call. Hi, Marisa. Thanks so much for all your clarifications. There's one thing that I'm not sure I understood very well. So the reason I put myself in the queue was to see if you can clarify the part of the 5 points for the deed or the ground lease. Are these 5 points just for people who have, site control from the municipality? Is that the intent of these 5 points?
No, that was the way that was phrased. Was the intent was to recognize whether it's a flat out deed, so a deed in the name of the applicant entity itself, or a lease from a local government, and so then the ownership interest would be in the local government itself. But again, I think we're going to continue that conversation, but it wasn't solely directed to benefit only developments that had a relationship with a local government. It was intended to recognize if outright an applicant owns a parcel, that would also receive the points.
Okay. No, that's fine. I mean, I think, I want to echo some of the previous comments, especially the one made by Tim Shell. I think, it's a very good comment, and so that's it for now. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rodrigo.
We have no more upcoming questions.
Okay. No one else in the queue for related applications. All right. Well, we'll move on, and if that changes at any point, as we, again, get to the end of the agenda, and open up the lines more. If something comes to you, feel free to get back in the queue, anybody about this issue. So the next item on page 2, number 6, is additional developer experience points. And we talked about this at the previous workshops, and I think we did talk about a point value associated with this, that it would have to be implemented during not 2020 funding cycle, but you all will be on notice in the RFAs going forward that in the following cycle we would have 15 points for applicants that have not had any related applications in credit underwriting. So that's a reference back to the definition we talked about earlier on the last section 5 of the agenda. In credit underwriting, with more than one exchange of housing credits or more than one second extension of a corporation designated deadline in the preceding 12 months. So we did listen to feedback, and we do understand that developments that have HUD funding associated with them sometimes are, that's an issue in and of itself. And so we're talking about here adding an exemption for those developments that have HUD funding associated with them. So it's like we have to balance all of the, the competing interests and the competing positions, and all coming from places that are valid about these items that we have brought forward in the agenda. So, earlier when we first started talking about ability to proceed, a couple of the comments referenced, you know, if we go forward with this this recommendation that we have or this requirement that we're looking at in number six, that it could and will have the potential to be very powerful in terms of folks making sure that due diligence is done on the front end. And so this is something that I think we really are committed to continuing and putting in and going forward with. The other piece that's not on this agenda but we talked about previously, and if those of you who have been following rule development know, we are evolving some with regard to the credit swap discussion and how we're looking at credit swaps going forward as well. So so stay tuned for how all of that will be intertwined. But, you know, there has been a little feedback about this with regard to concern about what the pandemic means and what we don't know it means yet for developments that are currently in the pipeline, in the development pipeline. And what we know, at least from the credit side of things, is that, you know, we do have the ref proc that allows for, you know, an administrative extension of deadlines. We are taking requests for those to be applied, and I think it's safe to say that if there's something that falls under of that nature, an emergency or a disaster declaration, that it's likely we would exclude something like that from this this type of implementation. But overall, we really are committed to implementing this in some way going forward. So I just wanted to open up the lines because this is also a pretty discreet issue that we've talked about. But it wouldn't have, again, we're putting the warning in this upcoming cycle, and then it would be applied in the following year's funding cycle. So with that, operator, if you can remind folks how to get in the queue, and we'll take any comments or questions about the additional developer experience points.
Absolutely. So everyone, if you wish to ask a question or add any comment, please press star one on your telephone. We have an upcoming line, and it's from Francisco Rojo.
Hey, it's me again. Yeah, I'm going to break a rule. I'm going to briefly commend you on this, and I just want to go back to the preceding comment, so I apologize for that. But as it relates to your developer experience points, I think it's a great idea. So fast forward, make it happen. I wanted to just add one comment, Marissa, with regards to the prior item, and I'm not sure if you were referring to what I'm going to mention when you mentioned about the sort of side deals related in the concept of related applications. And I had sent a public comment on this, and what I would say is, if from Florida Housing's perspective, you can consider in connection with the comment that I sent, or anything you believe that is related to it, if you could consider the idea that that you're proceeding with an RFA and you believe that there's foul play, and you want to think about ahead of time things that you want to describe that are activities that are counter to your intention, and you want to explicitly say that in your RFA or the certification, I would encourage that. And in particular, what I'm thinking about is a number of these items in this definition of these concepts are sort of items that are applicable after the fact, that you could audit after the fact. And what I think you ought to consider is adding duties, descriptions, that things that you believe a developer should be doing, that they should not be contracted to a third party or a related other entity to perform those duties. So that if an applicant believes that there is, or a competitor believes that there's been a problem, that they can highlight it, and it can be dealt with at the challenge level before projects are awarded. So anyways, I just wanted you to think of that a little bit, because I think, you know, you want to have your own tools, and you want the development community to have tools that they can use in the challenge period. Okay? So thank you.
Thanks, Francisco, and that is, I mean, your last statement there is exactly what we're looking for. The tools on both ends of the spectrum, ours and you all's as stakeholders. So I appreciate that. Anybody else in the queue, operator? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Experience point, absolutely. I think it's a great idea.
Thanks.
The next one is Delia Tabora. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I wanted to ask a question regarding the 50-year ground lease, actually, just making sure what the definition of local government is going to be. Does it include housing authorities and CRA, for example?
I believe the way that we if we capitalized it, it would be the, I'm sorry, because I'm not thinking about that subject item right now.
I'm sorry, I brought it back up.
Local government is capitalized, so it would be the way we currently define local government, which does not include CRAs or PHAs, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
The next one is Ken Mailer. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Marissa. It's Ken Mailer. I think you're definitely headed in the right direction with the additional developer experience points. One thing that we might want to think about while heading in that direction is there are different development types and you know, and different development sizes, and a 200-unit high-rise is going to be built a lot more slowly than a 20-unit garden-style development. So you've got that dynamic to contend with, and you've also got just different realities of permitting in different municipalities. So this might be an RFA by RFA, just revisiting some of Florida Housing's typical deadlines to make sure that they're sort of realistic for that given RFA. But all that said, those are details. I'm a fan of the concept in general.
Marissa, I think you're on mute. Okay, so Marissa just came off of the call. She'll get back on shortly. Operator, is there anybody else in queue?
Yes, we have Rodrigo.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about the, or probably give a comment regarding this 15 experience points. You know, it would be very important to define exactly what does, you know, the extensions mean. For example, like, you know, what is it, an extension that is going to be a problem? Because there's a lot of extensions that are sometimes requested in a development, let's say, for example, a 10% test extension. I guess we're not referring about that. We're referring to important extensions, and that's number one. Number two is, you know, when you say more than one extension, are we referring to more than one extension on the same development or more than one extension in the overall developments of that related party applications? And then third, you know, I want to echo Ken Naylor's comment that, you know, maybe it's better to define, to avoid, you know, retroactivity, that you know, to define RFAs, you know, because even 2017 or 2018 RFAs could be, you know, developments from all RFAs could be, having a penalty for not complying with this when we go and apply next year. So I don't know if Marisa went back on, but that's my comment.
All right. Well, I've made note of that, and I'm not privy to all the things she's got designed into this process, so I'll have to pass on that comment, but those are good suggestions and comments. I appreciate that, picking that through for us.
And Kevin, one last thing, the credit swaps, there's, it's very rare for two credit swaps to happen on the same deal, but sometimes the credit swaps could be avoided by, getting applications submitted, the application cycle being submitted, being earlier in the year so that we have more months to get there, especially now with pandemic and all that. It would be avoidable to have, to be allowed to have more time to comply with the Section 42 requirements.
Well, I do know we try to forward as much as we can. I think the awards, so the awards that for RFA is going out beginning, say, August, it would be 2021 credits. Now, they may not be awarded until December or sometime next year, so there is some lost months there. But we do try to get them out early enough in the year to give you the majority of the entire two-year process for that. And, of course, some of the things you mentioned are actually a one-year process from carryover date. So we'll have to take a look at that process and see what we can do to help that out. Thank you.
Yeah, the other item that worries us is sometimes the investor limited partner is the one who's actually asking for credit swaps that are probably not even necessary, you know what I mean? So it's sometimes driven by the investor and, it's not something that – it could be an unintended consequence that we'll be scaring away investors because we cannot give them comfort, So in general, what I guess my more important comment is that I think it has to be in a case-by-case situation. It cannot be like, okay, you have two things that you requested extensions for, and, there could be a real force majeure situation. Maybe the developer was very diligent, and maybe he's dealing with a very slow municipality or whatever. So it's not that I think that's happening right now, but I don't know what the pandemic would do to time frames right now. So I just don't think that the consequence could be all the time fair if this is not more like a, okay, we analyze your extension, we're gonna give you your extension, but you're gonna get 15 less points because you were not diligent. Maybe that's a better approach. When you guys approve the extensions, you can discuss if that extension deserves or not a thing to get 15 points. You know what I mean? Maybe that's something that a better approach, I feel. Thanks. That's all.
All right.
This is Marissa. Sorry, Kevin. Thanks for covering. I fell off the call. I just wanted to I'll wait for your response, and I wanted to respond back to something that was mentioned there.
Okay, now I was going to say, I was going to repeat what I basically heard in some reform is perhaps instead of stating a generic second extension that we need to go into a little bit more detail or a definition of what could be in there to get some ideas of what may or may not fall in those things so they have a better idea. But I know I'll let Marissa talk about this further, but I do know in general – Florida Housing usually says that any issues arising from failure to deliver timely is usually on the developer, and you, as a developer, you need to choose your partners wisely. So with that, I'll pass it back to you, Marissa.
Thanks, Kevin. And I just wanted to, the other things I wanted to touch on that came up there was the reference to investors or syndicators pushing the request for exchange of credits, and that was why we did a lot of due diligence talking to those partners in the process about how we could change some of our requirements to be more digestible for them in terms of when the assurance of a administrative credit exchange would be acceptable and things like that. So we feel very confident, and you know, like anything can change, of course, but we feel confident in the approach we have going forward about how we're going to be looking at credit exchanges. And frankly, I don't see a process going forward where we would make a determination on the meritoriousness, for lack of a better way of putting it, of a extension and how that would be a future implication. I think we're just committed to across the board there being an understanding, and then broadly, if there are any, I mean, like I used the pandemic example specifically, there was a significant event that happened, and you know, the IRS made some acknowledgments related to that disaster declaration, and so those things may come up. But overall, I think that we're committed to this as a broad, what you have in the pipeline is, you know, what you've got to be able to see through appropriately. And those commitments that are made at application are how that's going to work. And you're going to have the diligence on the front end to hopefully get through that process. So I appreciate the comments, but I think that we are committed going in this direction and maybe while at the same time fleshing it out a little bit more on the front end. But I wanted to be able to jump to I apologize. I made the mistake of, instead of pressing the mute button, pressing the hang-up button, and it took a long time to get back in the call. So, Kevin, anybody that is a Florida Housing person hopefully is laughing at that, because it happens actually quite a bit here the way some of our phones are. So I think we'll move on. And again, the developer experience points, as you all can digest some of that, we may come back to that. But I want to hit on the next item on the agenda, which is number 7, we're going to be hearing from Kevin for a little bit, continuing to hear from Kevin on the AB leveraging classification, and Gene will have some notes on that as well.
Well, thanks, Marissa. So as part of my annual math assignments in the summertime is to look at how the AB leveraging has processed, as well as the quintile tiers that we've looked at as well. And so what I typically do is I'll look at, I'll pick a couple of RFAs that are the major ones, which this past year it's 2019-113, which is the small median county GO, and then 2019-116, which is the sale bond 4% RFA. And what I do is I go through and assume every applicant that came in was eligible for funding, and how would they all be assigned an AB leveraging given that. And then looking at anything that is glaringly, like there is a certain slice and dice item that is advantaged or one that is disadvantaged in that process. So there's one that is, if you come in under one circumstance, it is likely you will get a B or a 4 or 5 rating tier, and likewise you might get an A almost every time or every time, or 1 or 2 tier level, and to see if what I can do to massage the numbers to have a little bit better distributed across the A's and B's, or on the 5-tier process, having them average somewhere around 3, give or take. And so, and look at that, there are 2 primary development types that I noticed that fill in that criteria. One was that high-rises were very well advantaged over the other development types, which may or may not be good for certain RFAs. We did get one comment about perhaps that should be favored on 9%, but not favored in a 4% procedure. But also, I note that garden apartments were disadvantaged. They were more likely to get a lower tier assignment or fall into the B range than the expected split of like 20% for the Bs kind of thing. And so what I need to do is then maybe look at some of these things and how they're panning out. Of course, the table on 7A shows you what we typically have offered on multipliers and then my current ones and then the proposed ones. And the basis boost, I know, you know, going back in the time machine, it used to be a 1.3 multiplier because the higher request amounts were 30% higher than the non-boost request amounts. And it was believed that the same number of units were delivered, but these cost more. But it turns out that was not the case, and it eventually got down to 1.1. But I think with recent cost increases, the number of additional units being delivered has not been as great. So I wanted to increase that slightly. So I moved that to 115. And before I go on to the rest of those, though, I do want to point out that all of these are interrelated. You just can't change one and fix something. In most cases, there are at least two multipliers on any given application, and there might be as many as five of these working on one application. And so adjusting one will affect something that maybe could be, if it's a wrong direction, it can be corrected by doing something else, another multiplier. And so by doing this, it's a whole scheme of multipliers you have to consider here. And I did notice that Broward, although they do need a multiplier, they were somewhat advantaged with the 85. And I do want to point out that because these are all interrelated, you probably shouldn't focus on why any one was moved up or down or affected that way because they are so interrelated. But you can see most of these things just had some minor tweaks to it. And the biggest one here, though, is the garden, because almost nearly all the times the gardens were not really in the A's or not in the upper tiers in the bond cycle. And so I felt the need to give garden a little bit better situation, and providing these proposed numbers, almost every issue was corrected or improved. And so I feel that these are good numbers to work into each one. They look, without knowing any numbers, they kind of look logical if you just think them through a bit as well. I think there's some good numbers to go through. And I do want to point out that we had one stakeholder comment that, which I believe to be true logically, that, you know, properties like elderly who have a large concentration of one-bedroom units might be disadvantaged because, you know, the cost per square foot is going to be up, the income is going to be down, you're going to need to ask for more credits to help out or more sale or something. And actually, I looked at that, and elderly was not disadvantaged. In fact, the lower average bedrooms per unit were not actually disadvantaged either. And so although logically that made sense, I do appreciate the comments from stakeholders to say, hey, can you think about this? And I'll for sure look into that and process that, and then so that at least we can make some informed comments going forward. So I do appreciate that a few stakeholders have reached out and talked to me about these things. And so the table there is those that are presented for the next RFA cycle. At this point, I'll just pass along to Jim.
Thank you, Kevin. And I'll talk about B in that section with regard to the AB leveraging. An AB leveraging classification is used in the preservation and the geographic housing credit RFAs. And we have some language here. That first paragraph, we proposed a lot of this language in December workshop. But we didn't say in that last sentence, that was the new part, but we didn't say how lottery would be used. We just ended the sentence with the applications to be further sorted using lottery number. So now we've added with the highest or worst lottery number being listed first. So that language is new and part of our new proposal. And then it goes on to say that the total number of applications on the list, we multiply by 80%, and the resulting figure will be rounded up to the next whole number, and that's our AB cutoff. And a line will be drawn below the applications whose place on the list is equal to that AB cutoff with apps, that last sentence, applications above that line will be A's, and applications below the line will be B's. So regarding that line, in previous cycles, we've been dropping that line and picking up any tied values and making them A's as well. So in December, we proposed dropping the line to just one spot, picking up the first application with the tied score only, but now we're removing that language as well. We aren't dropping the line. We aren't picking up any applications with tied scores anymore. And this is all specific to AB leveraging, but we'll also be doing the same thing in sale leveraging. When we do our sale leveraging levels, we also will do the calculation where that line will be between each level, and we will not be dropping that line. But we'll do a similar process in our proximity levels, and we will actually drop the line in proximity levels. Any values that have tied proximity scores in those RFAs where we do the proximity levels, we will bring up any tied proximity scores to bring them up to those higher levels. Thank you. And Kevin, again, I think you're going to talk about the next section.
Oh, yeah. So number eight, local government contribution amounts. And so, you know, that top table in this section shows you the local government area of opportunity funding amounts listed in RFAs this past year. And as you can see, there are 21 numbers out there. So it was, you know, we had been requested to make this process a little more simpler. And so we did that. And of course, the second table are the proposed numbers going forward for that particular funding amount. Now, what I did to get there, I know people and local governments, developers and local governments, it's difficult to plan ahead when you adjust numbers every year, especially when they're based on the TDC prudent limitation numbers. And so beginning in 2017, we've been using the 2017 limits and have used those same limits. And this will be the fourth year in a row we're using the same ones. We're trying to not be, increasing these things just because costs go up. We're just fixing these on the same map as created several years ago. And then the new numbers are basically the average of the new construction garden non-ESSC, or what we call wood, and then the new construction high-rise developments. The average is basically it's the lowest TDC and the highest TDC per unit for new construction. You average those two together and round to the nearest $10,000. And that's how you get the $640,000 proposed for Broward and Palm Beach counties and the $610,000 for the rest of the large counties that are not Miami-Dade. And then from there, we're going to have one for medium counties, but we didn't want to hinder the medium-small counties versus medium-large counties. And so the medium-large counties were basically processed in the same manner they had been in the past, is taking 75% of the non-South Florida limits and creating that. So the 460 represents 75% of the 610. And then for medium-small, we took 75% of that number. So 340, which is suggested, is 75% of the 460. And so that's how we came to these numbers. I suggest we probably will get responses with that, but that's how we came to that. And we thought just going down the middle, doing an average, might be the best way to go for this thing.
And Kevin, I just wanted to jump in there too. if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Because this relates a little bit to things that were on the last agenda that are not on this agenda because they've been sort of set in stone. So you see on here the proposed minimum local, the new proposed minimum local government area of opportunity amounts, and Orange and Hillsborough are included in the chart. But this is just a reminder, in the large six RFA, those are the two counties where the funding goal will be for a geographic area of opportunity application. So, and that's not repeated in here anywhere else. So I just didn't want anyone to walk away seeing this thinking, oh, now that's also going to be, those are all six of the counties are going to be goals for that in this RFA. That's not the case. But when it does come back into the fold, this is the, when those counties come back in the fold, that's the number that they would be. Thanks, Kevin.
Sure. So unless you want to stop, Marissa, I'm going to go on and start with nine here.
Yeah, I think let's go through TDC, and then we'll take some. We'll open up the line after that. That sounds good.
Okay. And so what I've done with the new limits for TDC was I increased the majority of these by 3.5%, which actually has been probably the largest increase we've experienced since 2015. So I've tried to recognize the costs that continue to go up, and they're going up faster than they have in the past. So I've added a little bit extra for this year at 3.5%, and then, of course, I round to the nearest $100. Now, one note here, you know, there's a concept I presented at the March large workshop where the rehab numbers, they appear to have gone down, which they have gone down in general, but what's happening here is this new concept, these TDC numbers here do not include any acquisition costs. In the past, the numbers would include the building allocation within these limits. And since acquisition costs are controlled by an appraisal, I thought that I didn't need to double limit those and hinder rehab costs, new rehab costs for any development. So the process in which what we were implementing here was presented at the last workshop. There's a white paper on our website that kind of discusses it. But basically, the numbers presented going forward for rehab are just the new construction costs incurred, which would be its own, you know, BIN numbers. And because everything in this table are actually new construction costs, then the post-application escalation rate will be the same for all of these in here. There won't be one for new construction and separate one for rehab. They're all going to be the same number. And what I presented here is they will be 5% escalation post-application, which follows the board's approval in March as well of changing it to consider that developers are taking a little bit longer to get started on the construction than the past. So we've raised up this number, and we're matching the board-approved number from March for going forward. And one thing I do want to point out here that, you know, the TDC pre-limitation process is, you know, we take many pages to describe it in the RFA and Exhibit C, and it can be complicated. Now, staff and credit underwriters do have a template that we all use to help us go through all the various scenarios for this thing. And that template will actually be posted fairly soon on our public website so that all the stakeholders have access to it and can use it as well to help them out. In addition to that, I've created a video, it's 40 minutes long, of how to use that template to walk you through it, understand what it's doing, how to enter your numbers, and then read the results. Once those things are posted, we'll send out a list of announcements letting you know it's there. But that should be coming out soon, so the whole stakeholder environment can actually use this. And the template itself actually incorporates all RFAs back to the beginning of TDC per unit limitation time. So if you ever had one, it's there. So that'll be made available soon. And one thing I do want to point out that, you know, Exhibit C language for TDC per limitation is something that, of course, I wrote. And it can be confusing, I can see, to a lot of people out there. And I've had a volunteer from staff who doesn't speak math as their first language to help out. And so we are going to rewrite that section in the back to have it attempt to be more plain language, less math verbiage, and to help out people understanding it. And I think between the new language and the video and the template, that hopefully this process will be more open to people that are subject to the limitations. And with that, I'll let Marissa.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Number 10 on the agenda is just the, you know, the new percentages for ELI AMIs, and so that's just there. And then the next item is proximity, so that's going to be a probably robust discussion. So now I think it would be a good time to open the lines back up for any of the items, particularly regarding AB leveraging, the TDC limit analysis, and those new numbers we have for local government contributions for the local government area of opportunity funding preference. So, operator, if you can remind folks how to get in the queue, please.
Yes, of course. So to get into the queue, you just need to press star 1. And actually, we have an upcoming line. It's from Chris Shear. Please go ahead.
Hi, Chris Shear McDowell. Jane, this question is for you. I saw that, you know, you guys were planning to omit what was discussed back in December and then again in March in relation to how you would handle ties within the AB leveraging. Seemed to be a lot of support for the methodology you're proposing previously, and I think CAP maybe even came to a consensus on that one. What's the thought process behind now omitting that?
About dropping the like we had the language where we were going to go down one application and now we're just drawing the line where it is.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'm sorry. I read that wrong then. I thought we were going back to having it open such that it all down to to include all of the tied applications.
No. Thank you for asking that. I'm glad to clarify. We were, in December we proposed just dropping it down one spot on the line. We were going to use lottery to figure out who would be the top one, but we were just going to drop the line one spot. But that was, you know, probably not really getting at what we needed to do. We're just going to draw the AB line where it is when we do that 80% calculation, and we're not dropping the line at all now.
So if you have multiple applications that are tied, how do you handle the top?
Yes, that's where lottery number will come in, but we're actually going to be having it reverse lottery number. So the highest lottery number, the worst lottery number, that might be your A, you know, leveraging value, but it'll have the worst lottery number.
Got it.
When you get down to the Bs, those might have the best lottery number, but any kind of tied corporation funding per set-aside amounts will be sorted by lottery number, and we're just going to, when we calculate that 80% line, we're drawing the line, not dropping the line at all. We're just going to draw that line, and anything above the line with the will be an A, and if we're splitting some with tied values, those A values will actually have the worst lottery numbers.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Understood.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up.
We have no other upcoming questions.
All right. Well, then we'll move right along to the And we're doing so well. I don't think we're going to mention possibly stopping for a break, but I don't think we're going to do that. The next aspect of the agenda on page 6, part 11, is proposed proximity changes. And so I just want to do a little tee up before I hand it off to Jean to talk about it more. We have received some feedback about the proposal here. Fundamentally, this proposal is not any different than what we put out in March, though it does have it is phrased to flesh it out a little bit more. But this is not a change from what we had discussed in March, and it indicated we were trending towards in December even. I'm just going to the only item that is really is related to proximity that we didn't include that was included in March was the new medical facility definition. So just I encourage you to go back and take a look at that. That's what will be included in the RFAs going forward. And the difference in this agenda is that we have modified the public school definition, but everything else is generally the same, and I'll turn it over to Jean to discuss more.
Thank you, Marissa. And two other things also that aren't on this, LDA information, limited development area information. Some of the documents, including a new data layer, have already been posted. We're going to also post a summary of what those new counties are today, and then a listserv will go out when all of the information is there. But some of the documents are already there. The rest will be going up today for the new LDA information. Also, I've started working on a proximity list draft. Of course, some of the litigation is still outstanding, so what I'll do is what I've done in the past with the shading of deals that are affected as much as I can. So once we get a little more clarification on those, if we can narrow down which deals will be affected by that litigation, I'll get a draft up there. So I've started working on it. It'll come soon when some of the litigation is either resolved or narrowing down more. So with item 11A, awarding proximity points to all transit and community services, this is just kind of a reminder information, what we've been talking about. As a reminder, community services, and those are the 4-point items, they're available to all demographics, the grocery store, medical facility, pharmacy, public school, and those new services, the public park and public library. The revised definition of public school was presented at our last workshop, and that's going to be expanded even further to add magnet schools, and the draft language is there on page 6. Each community service can earn up to 4 points. And the applications, all of our applications, regardless of demographic commitment, may provide information for any or all of the 6 community services. There's no limit anymore. The next item explains that we'll use quarter mile distances, and really that's for the new services in public school. Public school was the only service that was using half mile increments for distances and getting one point deductions as you move further out. So now public schools will be divided further into the quarter mile increments with half of a point deducted as you move further out, and those new services will do the same thing. So all applications can earn up to 30 total proximity points, and that's 4 points for each of those 6 community services, plus up to 6 transit service points. And then this is new. The definitions of public bus stop and public bus transfer stop, those are going to be expanded to include stops that qualify under the current definition and also stops that qualify under the previous definition. So I'd like to just kind of read you what has been drafted so far. So public bus stop definition will be a fixed location at which passengers may access one or two routes of public transportation via buses. That's the same. And then the public bus stop must service at least one bus route that either, one, has scheduled stops at least hourly during the times of 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and also during the times of 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., Monday through Friday, excluding holidays on a year-round basis, or two, has the following number of scheduled stops within a 24-hour period, Monday through Friday, excluding holidays, on a year-round basis. For the applicable county size, with small and medium counties having 12 scheduled stops and large counties 18 scheduled stops. So we're going to do the same thing for public bus transfer stop. Bring in that hourly requirement from the definition used in 2018 or the number of stops used in the definition in 2019. So proximity level system, we've been talking about this. I just kind of want to talk about this again to make sure we're all looking at it the same way. Proximity levels, they'll replace the proximity funding preference as a tiebreaker in the funding selection process in Miami-Dade and the medium-small geographic housing credit RFAs. We're going to sort and assign those, we'll sort those applications and assign proximity levels. It says here 1 through 5, and that's one of those that we've gotten a lot of public comments on. One of them was to make that 3 levels instead of 5. And yes, that's something that we plan to do. We're going to go ahead and make it 1 through 3, not 1 through 5 proximity levels. And thank you for those public comments. And we're going to do those 1 through 3 in a manner similar to the sale leveraging levels. And it goes on to talk about how each level will be 20%. And, of course, if we're doing 3 levels, they'll actually be 33%, you know, if we do the 3 levels like that. Thank you. So that's different than what's here on the agenda. And the proximity funding preference. So we'll still use the proximity funding preference in the funding selection process for the sale family elderly and the 6-county large geographic and preservation housing credit RFAs. We are making a change, though, to what we've been doing in the past, and that's because of those 2 new proximity community services, because there are now more points available. So these charts shown here raise those number of points needed for the proximity funding preference in the medium and large counties. There are no changes for any of the eligibility items or the small county items. So you'll see, like in the first chart, that's the 6-county large geographic and the preservation housing credit RFAs. And of course, really these changes in the 6-county large, these changes are only for the applications that qualify for the geographic areas of opportunity, because the proximity funding preference is not used in the local government area of opportunity goals. We're about C and D below. But I'll just kind of go over these charts real quick. You're probably familiar with these charts. You'll see that these columns regarding the eligibility, the required minimum transit points, whether it's eligible for the PHA or RD proximity boost or not, those haven't changed. The required minimum total proximity points that must be achieved to be eligible for funding, those haven't changed from what we've been doing in the past. Small county, none of those numbers have changed. The only changes we're making in this first chart is the total proximity points that must be achieved to receive the proximity funding preference, and those are higher for large county, medium county apps, again, because of those new services. And the sale family elderly RFA, those points have been increased even a little further for those large county, medium county points necessary to receive that proximity funding preference. So when we're in D, when we're selecting applications for the local government area of opportunity or revitalization goal in the applicable housing credit RFAs, applications that qualify for these goals, they're going to continue to automatically qualify for the following eligibility items, so those eligibility items being minimum transit score if applicable, minimum total proximity score, and the mandatory distance requirements. So they're still going to receive those automatically to be eligible for funding on those items without submitting anything further. And then we provide a list of tiebreakers that will be used only when we're selecting those applications to meet the local government area of opportunity or revitalization goal. And note, there are no proximity tiebreakers here. The proximity tiebreakers won't be used at all when we select applications for the local government area of opportunity or revitalization goals. And here those tiebreakers are that we will use. The first one, it says that it's a preference for applications from jurisdictions that were not awarded in 2019, and that's used in the small and medium county RFA. Preference wasn't really maybe the best word here on this agenda, because this is going to work more like what we had in the 2019 small medium GO. In 2019, we excluded Alachua, Manatee, and Polk from being able to compete for this goal, because in the previous year, 2018, the applications that qualified for the local government area of opportunity goal and were awarded funding through the RFA, those were for proposed developments located in those counties. So they were excluded in 2019. And we're going to continue that same policy this year in 2020 by excluding those counties where the proposed developments are located that are awarded funding in 2019-113 that qualified for the local government area of opportunity goal. And we're going to do the same thing for the revitalization goal, which was new in 2019. And we'll be doing the same policy in 2020. So the counties where the applications that qualified for the revitalization goal and were awarded funding in 2019-113, and that's whether they selected the revitalization goal or another part of the selection process. Any proposed developments in those same counties this year, they're not going to be eligible for the revitalization goal this year. They'll still be eligible to apply for the RFA, but just not eligible to qualify for those goals. So the litigation for RFA 2019-113 has not yet been resolved. So we don't have a list of which applications got funded where yet. It is our hope that the final orders are going to be brought to the July board meeting. And then the other tiebreakers, the per unit construction funding preference, development category funding preference, AB leveraging classification, job creation preference, and lottery. And again, you'll see that those do not include any of these proximity tiebreakers we've been talking about. And then there's a note that says applications that qualify for the local government area of opportunity or revitalization goal but were not selected to meet these goals, they can continue to be selected for funding in the remaining selection process using the tiebreakers in E below. So the tiebreakers in E, these are used for the preservation housing credit RFA, the SALE family elderly RFA, and the three geographic housing credit RFAs when not selecting applications to meet the local government area of opportunity or revitalization goal. And again, another note about how applications that qualify for the goals but weren't selected to meet the goals, they'll continue to be selected for funding in this remaining process using these tiebreakers. So first we have the per unit construction funding preference, the development category funding preference, and that's used only in the three geographic housing credit RFAs, and either the AB leveraging classification that's used in the preservation and geographic housing credit RFAs, or those SALE leveraging levels as applicable. Then we have the proximity tiebreakers, and we'll be using either the proximity level or the proximity funding preference as applicable. Preference for applications that are within 2 miles of a grocery store, whether they're within the 2 miles or not, it'll be yes-no question. The application's actual proximity points for the two highest community services, and again, those community services are just those 4-point items. And then in the geographic housing credit RFAs for large counties where we require a transit score, we're going to have a tiebreaker for the actual transit score, followed by the job creation and lottery. And that was a lot of information. Marissa, I don't know if you wanted to go into the next item or if you'd want to pause again for any questions.
I think it would be good to pause for questions. Thanks, Jean, and for making sense of, what were a lot of words here on the agenda trying to get our points across. So I think it'd be a good time to stop. And operator, if you can let folks know how to get in the queue again, we'll take some comments or questions about proximity.
Yes, of course. So if you wish to get in the queue, please press star 1 on your telephone. And we have some upcoming lines. The first one is Oscar Sol. Please go ahead.
Hey, Jean. Wanted to just go back for a second to the leveraging question. Have you guys considered trying to consider unit type, i.e. studio, one bedroom, two bedroom, three bedroom, into your leveraging calculation? I say that because the way you've got it set up right now, it's really difficult to build 3- and 4-story units without basically being a B-leverage deal. So it's hard to kind of really cater to more family-oriented developments. And I'm curious if, it'd probably be pretty complicated, but, Kevin, to your point you raised that senior deals weren't really disadvantaged. I think the reason is because they're mostly smaller unit types. So they're kind of automatically going to be cheaper per unit. But when you try to do family developments, it's just larger units, more bedrooms, it's going to be more expensive per unit. So I'm just curious if that was part of your discussion.
And Kevin, did you want to answer that?
Yeah, so I went through and I analyzed five different ranges of average bedroom counts per unit, and I did ones up to 1.5 bedrooms, and then up to 2, and then 2.25 or 2.5, and then above that. And generally speaking, the larger the average bedroom count, it got a little bit, say, worse off than the prior positions, but they weren't significantly disadvantaged. They're still almost right in line with the expectations. They hovered right around 20% on both sides. So at this point, you know, without any additional information from stakeholders, I'm not leaning towards that. So if there can be some more comments on that, I mean, I've got to look at it, but it has to be done fairly quickly because we don't want to surprise anybody, basically, you know, as the RFPs are issued.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, look, I can just tell you, you know, I don't have the amount of data that you have, but I think we're definitely all in the development community consciously probably push more towards smaller units in order to try to become an A-leverage deal. I mean, it's definitely happening. I think maybe something as simple as if you're a senior deal or if you're a family deal and you commit to a certain number of, you know, units or maybe 3 or 4, then you get some kind of a leveraging boost. Maybe something like that might correct that anomaly there. I'm sure other people might have other thoughts on that, but I'm pretty sure, generally speaking, smaller units are going to be less expensive per unit, and right now your calculations don't account for unit type at all. It's just on a straight per unit basis, so there's no doubt that a one bedroom is cheaper to build per unit than a 3 or 4 bedroom. I mean, there's no question about that. So just consider that.
But there's also there's also less income being generated as well.
It's true, but I mean, in my experience, it's the additional income doesn't even come close to offsetting the added cost. But that's just kind of from my perspective. See if anybody else has thoughts on that. As far as the proximity, definitely appreciate the flexibility there. As far as, because I think 5 levels was probably going to be a little bit too extreme. My concern on that was really that it's if you have a system where 80% of your applications potentially will have very little chance of getting funded. That's a little bit it's sort of scary to make that big of a change, I guess. So I would have erred on the side of baby steps, and I was thinking maybe even just half and half, you'd have 2 levels, might be a little bit more prudent than having 5 levels because it's just such a drastic change. But, you know, 3 levels, you know, you land it somewhere that's better than 5, so that's pretty good. Totally support the idea of the developer points. I think that's a great idea. Agreed with a lot of the previous comments about site plan approval and ability to proceed. I think Chris Shear actually had some good ideas on that, which I think should definitely be explored. But otherwise, I appreciate the time.
Are there any other questions on the line?
Yes, we have 4 upcoming. The next is from Danny Lopez.
Hi, this question is for Gene. Gene, you mentioned earlier that the proximity scoring for public schools, parks, and libraries is going to be further subdivided into quarter mile distances, which you also discussed in the March 5th workshop. And I just wanted to ask you a question. I'm looking at the March 5th workshop agenda. And the first category is 0 to 0.5 miles, and then the other categories are then quarter mile distances. I just wanted to confirm that 0 to 0.5 miles for parks, schools, and libraries will still get you those 4 points.
I'd have to look into that. We haven't discussed the actual chart recently, so thank you for asking. We'll have to look into that and see exactly what that breakdown is. I think the first category was a little bigger in the chart for the geos last year, but we haven't discussed exactly if we're going to follow that first you know, making the first one bigger or stick to the 0.25. So thank you for asking. We'll look into that.
Okay. Thank you.
The next one is Ryan Waterfield. Please go ahead.
Hi, Gene and Marissa. This is Brian Waterfield again with Tin Shell Development. I'm personally having a really hard time understanding the benefit of the proximity level system. So maybe if you could just briefly touch on what the goal is there, that would be great. But overall, I think that we don't believe that a change to the proximity preference policy from last year is necessary. If the goal of the proximity levels is to further reduce the amount of competitive applications, then as Marissa kind of touched on previously, we believe that this will absolutely be achieved with the priority designation of applications. And if for some reason it does not, what we would recommend is waiting until the next cycle to make additional big changes such as these that are currently being proposed for proximity. Also, I think it's important to consider that a system like the one proposed would significantly drive up land prices for the higher scoring properties, which of course is not the intent. If Florida Housing definitely intends to roll out the proximity level system, we would propose even further watering it down, as Oscar suggested, to a 50-50 system rather than a three-level system, and then perhaps considering further modifications in future cycles if necessary. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. This is Marissa. I will touch on that briefly. I think that after coming off of some significant feedback, stakeholder feedback, just overall, local governments, fellow funders, developers, just in general, the desire to move away from or explore a way in which we can move away from the lottery system while ensuring that what we're funding is, you know, it's hard to use a word to characterize it, but right, like, the best developments as possible with the most amount of proximity for intended residents as possible is a part of the thrust of looking at proximity this way. So we don't want to make the pendulum go, and as we discussed it, you know, when we first started talking about it back in December, of, you know, we don't want the pendulum to swing so far that is, you know, a point system that is resulting in what at least I understand anyways to be became problematic in 2011, where there's only, you know, one or two sites perhaps that meet a quote perfect score. This is a balance looking at the proximity level system, where we get to not the extreme of a straight out perfect point value, but we also get some differentiation that that gets us digging down a little deeper. And I think in that way, that's why it's, you know, we intend that to be meaningful, while fully recognizing, as Gene mentioned, maybe doing it a little more incrementally with the three levels as opposed to the five levels. And I think something that we're also willing to talk about is what is the right percentage of delineation within those three levels. So is it, you know, is each level 33%, or do we have a different type of percentage? But I think we really are committed to moving forward with this to see what the information tells us. And so definitely appreciate the perspective, definitely appreciate that there may be some consequences that result from it, but I think the goal behind it, we're committed to seeing through in some way.
Thanks, Marissa.
Thanks, Brian.
The next one is Chris Bryant. Please go ahead.
Thank you. This is backing up also to a question about leveraging. Can you explain for a minute so that I understand the logic behind the additional language that's added in there about when you have applicants with identical total corporation funding per set-aside amounts, that you're going to list them with the highest or worst lottery number? being listed first. What's the logic behind reversing the order for that group of applications? I mean, if the thought is that it would discourage a lot of applications being filed with the interest of chasing low lottery numbers, won't this just encourage a lot of applications to be filed with the interest of chasing high lottery numbers? But anyway, let me hear what your, if I can hear what the thinking is on that.
Sure. So it is with that intent in mind. But then what happens is ultimately it's a disincentive, because when you get ultimately to the final tiebreaker is still going to be that lowest closest to one lottery number. So if you flooded the application pool and have a significant amount of applications to tie in order to get at least one to have that line, it's going to be the one with the worst lottery number. And then you, when application, if it gets to lottery in terms of final funding selection, that final tiebreaker is going to go to the best lottery number. So it balances that out. And we certainly know, like, that's not a perfect system, but we're really trying to get the point across. And I think that is the way with, and the reason that we added that twist to that. And also knowing that not every RFA comes down to lottery as the final tiebreaker, but certainly some of them at this point do. And we don't know what will happen with some of the other pieces we're trying to implement.
Okay, thanks. I think I understand your intent. I'm not convinced that accomplishes it, but we'll see. Thank you.
And right, so, and one other thing I'll add is that, you know, we do also recognize sometimes there are naturally occurring ties. We've gone back and looked at the data, and we know that. And we also think this is a fair way to sort of separate that as well, where you have, you know, they're not related applications, and they're coming in with that same number because all of the items line up accordingly. And so it is, you know, sort of flips it on its head to normalize it in that way with randomly occurring ties. But, you know, it wouldn't have to be an issue if it wasn't an issue. So that's what we're trying to get across. Thanks.
The next one is Michael Hartman. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Marissa. This is Michael Hartman from Turnstone Development. I had a question slash comment on the proximity level tiebreaker. When we're looking at medium and small counties, should we have separate proximity levels for just the small county deals versus the medium county deals? Because typically the small counties would have less proximity score than the medium county deal, and it may end up that all of the small county deals will end up being in proximity level 3, so it would kind of negate the idea of that being a tiebreaker between the small county deal.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for that comment. And I don't want to speak for Jean if she'd already been thinking about this, but I or had something to say on it as well. So I'll mention and then turn over to her. That I think that's a totally reasonable thing for us to consider. And I think that, you know, there's capacity for us to do that analysis in the separate county size vacuums, kind of how we do, you know, our analysis when we talk about sale, and we do our analysis for rehab differently than we do for new construction. So, I think that's an interesting point. Jean, was there anything else you wanted, any input on that you wanted to add?
No, I agree. I was already jumping to the same thing. We do something similar in other RFAs, and I think that's a good point as well.
Thanks, Michael.
All right. Thank you very much.
The next one is Ken Naylor. Please proceed.
Hey, it's Ken Naylor with Atlantic Pacific. First of all, I just wanted to
Yeah, I agree with Oscar Sol on some of the bedroom type leveraging math. I think, Kevin, we struggle a little bit because the data set that you're looking at is based on applications that you've received that are reacting to the forces of the system that we've all been participating in for so long. So I think logically speaking, Oscar's right, and I think the offsetting rent does not pay for the extra bedrooms in most cases, and we end up building a lot smaller units as a result. So I would like to study that a little further. I think that's worth revisiting. On the subject of proximity, I think the corporation is headed in the right direction. Just one thought I had, which is libraries are sort of increasingly becoming a little bit of an anachronism, especially as we're all forced to do things digitally. A lot of what our tenants tend to use a public library for is, you know, really good internet access, assistance with governmental applications, special events, you know, these types of things, which are also satisfied by certain community centers, senior centers. So I might consider expanding that definition, and it may be more applicable to certain parts of the state than others, but certainly in Miami-Dade County, I think there's a way to expand that definition and get at the intent.
Thanks a lot, Ken. Appreciate the comments. I have my like visions in my mind of the last in-person workshop where we all talked about libraries so much, and some of those reasons that we felt the libraries were good to keep and meaningful right now are being stifled by all the stay-at-home issues we're all forced to deal with right now. So carry on that. The difficulty, you know, the reason we didn't include senior center and community center is that we didn't feel like we had a good way to put a solid definition around those, and they had been problematic definitions in the past. So what I would ask back is that if you think there's merit there, that that you or you all, you know, any stakeholders, give us some ideas about how we would go about defining that.
You got it. Thanks.
Thanks.
The next one is Rodrigo Paradis.
Hey, so it's me again, but I just wanted to say that we agree with the comments made by Brian from Tim Shell regarding proximity. I also want to, I agree with you, Marisa, regarding the definition for community center and senior centers was problematic in the past, and I think it's still going to be problematic. But I also wanted to say that, you know, even if Florida Housing decides to go forward with this further delineation with proximity, I would encourage you to revisit the tiebreakers on, you know, when it's not a revitalization or an LGL, like the sixth or seventh one, that you go back to the exact scoring. So besides having the leverage level or the quintile level or that one third or one second, like Oscar Sol said, by the way, I agree with that. It should be like, you know, a third or a half of the score of the max score. That should be like the tiebreaker. You know, but if you go beyond that to more to the specific score, like we have in the tiebreaker proposal, it's going to be again what happened in 2011, and that's problematic because I think that the public purpose of doing the proximity score is just to avoid sites that are in the middle of nowhere. You know, there's not going to be too much of a difference if you're scoring, you know, 19 versus 18. There's, there could be even a situation where the one that's scoring 18 is even better located. you know, because of, you know, it's not always about the distance between points. So, you know, I would encourage to make it more simple and not add so much tiebreakers that would go back to what the old proximity that it's, you know, who has to cite this course the best is the winner. That's it.
Thanks, Rodrigo. We'll take another, if there's another comment in the queue, we'll take that, but then we want to move forward to the last part of the agenda. I'd like to hopefully wrap up by about 12:30 at the latest. So, operator, do we have another call in the queue?
Yes, and it's from Chris Shear. Please go ahead.
Hey, I will be short as I can be. Just a quick echo to Oscar and Ken Naylor's comments. I haven't looked at the math in depth, but I will say that when we're running leveraging analysis and trying to meet our targets during pre-application time, we are adjusting unit types in practice and reducing numbers of three-bedrooms and four-bedroom units to try to meet a certain targeted leveraging level. That has been the result in practice that we have lost three- and four-bedroom units. So if it's important to drive larger unit types, I do think that is something that's worth considering on a bedroom basis versus a unit basis when it comes to calculating AD leveraging. Second question, Gene, the failed family elderly RFA has now increased to a 15-point minimum to meet the maximum in medium counties. Sale applications, you know, it's tough to make those deals work. It's really a function, and as the ranking methodology already takes into effect, a pretty prescribed ranking on the amount of funding you need to make the development work, and the lower request, obviously, is incentivized. So from a development seat, we're always looking for developments that have a lower, that are more efficient, a cheaper cost-built product, less development site work costs. We can buy land at a lower cost, and that's what really drives our initiative when we're looking at development deals under sale. I think putting in a higher threshold for proximity doesn't provide much value beyond that. To make good sale deals work, to drive more units, you already have a methodology in place. Increasing the proximity score to further delineate doesn't seem like it's serving a big public purpose there. So just something I wanted to throw out there looking at this is after that increased minimum to get the maximum proximity funding preference is really necessary, in particular in sale. I will just run through the last two. We have 10 goals outlined in medium, small housing credit RFA as proposed. 11 deals funded last year. Revitalization was a goal last year as well. I had noted that a number of the LGAOs also met the revitalization goal and qualified, and now we have a new SunRail goal. If we allocate the first 10 developments, there may not even be enough funding to fund another development outside of the goals. So I just recommend that we look at or consider including the goal to be met for revitalization or SunRail. If it's met by one of the LGAO applications that are funded or a preceding goal that is funded and that development qualifies for revitalization or SunRail, that it should have should qualify to have met that goal, and that opens up more funding on the back end for non-goal developments. The other question I had, and maybe I'm reading this wrong, is it states in here that if a development is an LGAO and it doesn't get selected under the LGA goal, then it goes into the regular pool of funding and will be competing against the rest of the applications under the other goals or in the open cycle. I'm reading that as the LGAO goal, once they're not funded, would automatically qualify them as priority one. And I think that's the right approach, but I just wanted to get some clarification on that. That if an LGAO deal is not funded, it moves into being ranked amongst the other priority one developers. And then the last thing Actually, that's it. So sorry to ramble, but I wanted to get those out there. Thank you.
Gene, do you mind if I jump in?
No, I was going to ask you if you wanted to. Go ahead.
Thanks. I'm just going to start where you left off, Chris, and glad you asked the question, because that is not what we're intending. And we can take further feedback or discussion about that. But you know, the way that and there's a reason for that. And again, we're willing to continue to talk through it. But the when applications come in and attempt to meet many goals. Oh my gosh, excuse me. Meet many goals. You know, we have moved to the format where we're only selecting. You know, getting selected doesn't eat up if an application meets all the goals. Eat up all of those goals in funding selection. And when we were talking about this and it started implementing that, the look to that approach a couple years ago, what we had in mind was the application that comes in as a local government area of opportunity application, but is also a geographic area of opportunity as well. And that if they're funded as a geographic area of opportunity, they should not receive the benefit of automatic proximity, because that's not what the geographic area of opportunity goal is about. So you'd have to come in and still, if you're competing for that goal, you can be a local government area of opportunity, but if you want the opportunity to be selected for something else, you've got to still be able to meet those requirements. And so when we were talking about the designations and those developments going back in, if you don't get selected as a LGAO goal going forward and you become one or any of the other goals, and if there is space to pull up the sort of general application pool of next highest ranking eligible, that in order for us to determine whether or not this this delineation works and how it works, that those local government area of opportunity applications would have to compete with the general pool, and they would, if you come in and either, you know, we see it both ways with those type of applications that come in when they automatically are getting the score. Sometimes they still give us the proximity services because they want to make sure that they've had the backstop of everything just in case they're scored differently for another reason. And sometimes they don't at all because they say, you know what, I automatically qualify, and maybe they don't have those points anyway. So it's up to the decision of the applicant whether they're going to provide that, but they're not going to automatically be slated as the first third of the designation of those the proximity scoring. Sorry, that got a little like tangled, but I was trying to explain the thought process behind it.
Well, I think I understood that. I would just say if that's the case, then you're having to designate LGAOs as priority ones, then I think that further serves as a sensible measure to increase in small, medium counties the number of priority ones that that can be submitted amongst, you know, the other reasons that if your LGAOs are priority ones. Just in case they don't get funded under that, which 13 counties were represented last year, so your chances are still pretty small. At least it, you know, you have additional applications beyond your LGAO apps that can compete.
And so, right, I was conflating what you asked with what I thought you were asking. So I wasn't thinking about it, and I was thinking about the preference level for proximity and level one, as opposed to what you are talking about, I now realize, which is truly the priority one, priority two application designations. My answer is still the same, but what I will say is I think, you know, we're willing to, what I mentioned at the very beginning, look at broadening the number of priority one applications, to your point there. So that, just to bring that full circle, I recognize I wasn't talking about the same thing. Now, I got all caught up in that, and you had another comment. Oh, and this is really going into number 12, so we're just going to segue into that as well, number 12 in the agenda where we're talking about the goals. The reason I think it makes it's an interesting concept with regard to the SunRail goal, particularly that if that is represented in one of the local government area of opportunity selections or revitalization, that may make sense. I'm more reticent to state that an LGAO application that is selected that also happens to be revitalization would meet that goal as well, because what we know is that there are local governments that are not in a position, that are interested in revitalization, have a plan, have a desire for their communities with local community revitalization, but they don't have the local government area of opportunity funding contribution amount. And we want to have a space for them to be able to compete. And, you know, this was a consolidation of another RFA into a funding goal of this RFA. And so I don't think that we would particularly move away from that, though I do understand, I mean, the data speaks for itself with what came in last funding cycle. But I do think it's interesting for us to look at potentially how the SunRail goal would apply to that. And I'm also just going to jump right into, because we're in Section 12, that something here that in all likelihood we're going to be removing from the goals for the medium and small county geographic RFA, which is the 100% nonprofit goal. And I don't think we're going to be moving that to any other general occupancy RFA at this point in time. I mean, we've been able to go back and analyze. It really falls down to two things. We've been able to analyze that we're meeting our federal and QAP requirements for the housing credits to be allocated to nonprofits. So we feel good about that. But also, as many of you know, and have experienced or observed, maybe is a better way to put that, you know, getting our arms around truly funding a 100% nonprofit in the way that we think would be meaningful to provide capacity to a nonprofit is something that's meaningful to us, and I don't know that it's being accomplished by incentivizing a just generally 100% nonprofit goal. So we're going to be looking internally about our approaches with regard to some of that, and in the meantime, we're probably not going to include that goal in the small medium RFA, and we're not going to add it in the large six or the Miami-Dade RFA as a replacement either. So we'll be still talking through some of those, through some of the goals that we have going forward. But another big topic that was not on this agenda, which was in the, which was discussed in December and included in the March agenda, was our the goals in our Miami-Dade RFA. So we don't really need to talk about large six. I've already touched on that, you know. Hillsborough and Orange County are the geographic area of opportunity goals. The other counties are local government area of opportunity funding goals. We're still doing a second Broward award. We are not adding a second award to any other local governments, and that's consistent with the rental market needs study, what we're using as our guide point for that. So we're not moving from that at this point. For Miami-Dade, we are still planning to include the urban center goal as presented, and you'll recall there was tier one urban centers and tier two urban centers. And we have received some feedback about concern from developers in Miami-Dade County about whether or not what we're doing may be exclusive of other, meritorious locations, particularly in the city of Miami, that have, access to transit and are sort of up-and-coming areas. And so I just wanted to give some space for folks who may have anything to say about the Miami-Dade goals as well. And but we're I think, committed to the urban centers. We are looking at how we designate those. We do understand that there is, we have what we've talked about with mapping right now, in our mapping system, that there is some, those are not static at any, you know, certain point in time. So the urban center boundaries may change, and so we're talking about at what point in time we designate that the proposed development has to be included as a part of the boundaries of an urban center. So I just want to touch on those things very quickly, and then just go back to the phone lines for folks who are in queue. And I think we can kind of sort of talk about anything at this point. Really, that concludes the big parts of the agenda. There is a little subpart for an update on the emergency rule, and that only update is that the emergency rule is still in place, and we anticipate the substantiation for compliance with that would be through a self-certification of some sort, and you would not be required as an applicant to demonstrate anything other than a certification itself. So with that, I will go ahead and turn it over to the queue.
Okay, we have an upcoming line from Brian Waterfield. Please go ahead.
Hey, Marissa. Thanks for taking all these multiple comments, and I promise to make this quick. And the first one that I wanted to jump into is about the local government area of opportunity applications and the preference for previously submitted applications. I basically just wanted to clarify this preference. I know in prior years, municipalities that were awarded under the local government area of opportunity goal were ineligible from being funded under the goal for 2 years following, and we would strongly encourage for this policy to remain in place. I think giving a preference to previously submitted applications for the LGAO goal will lock out certain municipalities and developers from even competing for about half of the RFA's allocation. And because of this, what we would recommend is making it a goal to fund a previously submitted LGAO application rather than making it a preference. We can see this creating a lot of problems on the front end and potentially on the back end in litigation, specifically around defining what is classified as a previously submitted application. For example, does the application have to be from the same exact applicant and developer? And if so, how will this be monitored? And if it does not have to be from the same applicant and developer, how is it fair to the prior applicants and developers who put in the effort during a prior cycle to educate and negotiate terms with the municipality? So that's my concern about that one. I don't know, and I have two other things that I wanted to comment on, but I didn't know if you were going to have kind of like a general open session at the end or if this is the right time to make those comments, so let me know.
Well, you have been good about getting in the queue, so I would say now is the time, and I want to make sure when we open up, that's not a criticism per se, but I am concerned that we want to make sure if there's anybody else that's still in the queue, we reach them as well. So go with your other two, and then we'll continue to, I'll address some of those things, and we'll continue to move forward.
Okay, and I promise they're quick. The first one is back up to the addition of the parks and libraries, and I think you kind of touched on this in the definition of libraries, but I just wanted to state that there have been issues in other states that I'm sure that you've heard of where developers have actually used vacant lots to put on parks, and they've created their own libraries, and I just think it's extremely important that a strong definitions around both of those things are come up with if they are going to be included.
Thanks. And we actually, we have those proposed definitions in the previous, I think the March agenda, and with those things in mind. The one thing I really wanted to clarify is, and intended to when I jumped into this section, is that we will, a modification of the goals for the five local government area of opportunity applications discussion, it will not be a preference. The number that I think we've landed on at this point is that we would have a goal within a goal to fund three previously submitted applications. And totally hear what you're saying. We wouldn't be able to flesh all of that out today, but what we currently understand is that we would have to put some parameters around what that means in terms of previously submitted applications. So we're aware of that.
Okay, great. And then I'll make the other one really quick as well. The and this is in regards to the 5 points that we talked about up at the ability to proceed at the very beginning of the call for applications that include a deed or an executed lease with a local government for at least 50 years. And it's just our opinion. I'll provide a public comment, but we think that these points might help developers who have deep pockets that are needed to acquire land prior to the application deadline, or developers that already have negotiated land leases with local governments, but in general, we believe this point item will eliminate a majority of the competition from the rest of the development community, and in turn decrease development in a lot of different areas of the state. So our recommendation would be to remove the points for having a deed altogether, and either make it a goal to fund an application that has an executed lease with a local government, or find a way to give an application with an executed lease with a local government the same incentives as receiving a contribution from a local government for the local government area of opportunity goal.
Thanks for those comments, Brian.
Thanks, Marissa. I appreciate it. Sorry for all of them, and like I said, I'll post a public comment.
Great. All right, who do we have next in the queue?
The next is Francisco Rojo.
Kate, I'm back. Let's see. I was going to comment on the Miami-Dade. Marissa, you're opening up the floor for Miami-Dade and the goals. As I see it, so you've got a family. I'm kind of trying to pull it up here. You've got sort of geo SADDA family. You've got elderly, and you've got the tier one urban centers. So what I wanted to mention is, and I sent the public comment on this, as you look at these goals with regards to the urban centers, it yells at you that Miami, the city of Miami, is not part of it. And from a public purpose perspective, I really don't see a public purpose from excluding the city of Miami from this goal. I want to give you a couple of points. As you look, for example, at the goal for SADDA and GEO, the city of Miami is generally, this is a little bit of a broad statement, but is generally excluded from being able to participate in that. Meaning the price of land in the city of Miami, where you would be either GEO or SADDA, would be prohibitive. The cost to build would be prohibitive. And that doesn't necessarily apply to Miami-Dade County. So Miami-Dade County, as it's presently worded, Miami-Dade is really going to be benefiting on the urban centers because it's the only place that can participate in that, and also with regards to GEO and SADDA, and that just leaves elderly, and elderly could be city of Miami, could be anything. What I'm seeing is you've got the city of Miami where the incomes are relatively low, much lower than in the county, and it's being excluded from participating in this. And I frankly, as I see the city of Miami, you've got the city has their own TOD definition. They've got a great number of rail stations that serve what you're looking for in this tier one urban center goal. So I really am a little dumbfounded as to why the city is excluded from this. I think you have the same tools available to you with regards to limiting. I understand the city of Miami, over the years, there a number of developments have been funded close to transit stations, but I think you have the tools available to you to sort out, hey, you know what, we're going to define a Tier 1 and a Tier 2 within the city of Miami. And it can be that your Tier 1 definition, as it relates to existing projects, can be different from the one that you're using in the county. So I think you've got a huge opportunity. What you're doing is you're broadening a definition that you have, so you're not really saying, hey, those who have been proceeding on this basis, we're gonna not make you be able to apply for this, but I think you're just broadening the field, and I think it just makes a lot of sense. So I would really encourage you to think about it. You know, one thing I did is I also looked at the projects that are likely to get funded from the 19 RFA in Miami-Dade, and it looks like all of them, none of them is in the city of Miami. So I would ask you to really give some thought to that. You know, you've got, it is a very easy addition to make, and it is something that is very easy to measure. So I think that I think that the field is open for you to consider that.
Thanks a lot, Francisco. I think we can, what you're saying makes sense in many ways, so we'll definitely take a look at how City of Miami and what we can potentially designate there, how that plays into what we've already set forth for the urban center. So appreciate the comment.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Operator, anybody else in the queue?
Yes, we have three other people. The next one is Stephanie Lund. Please go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, Stephanie, hi.
Hi, thank you very much for holding this workshop, and I'm sorry if I didn't comment on this earlier. I was just thinking about it a little bit during the time related to the 5 points for an executed lease with a local government. I am thinking that there is also a situation where someone could have an executed lease with a land trust or the federal government for, you know, 50 to 99 years, and that could serve as demonstration of site control. So I don't think that it would always have to be that the city would have the land. And, you know, we try not to land bank if possible. So it is possible that we would have a priority project that would have an executed 99-year land lease with another entity, not us.
Thanks for the thanks for that feedback, Stephanie. We appreciate that, and we've learned a little bit coming through our CDBG RFAs where we had some priorities for use of land acquisition funds. So I what you're saying resonates. I understand. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
The next one is Delia Tabora.
Hi, Marissa. I just kind of wanted to echo Brian's comments regarding the preference for previously submitted applications. And more than that, kind of wanted to see if you could maybe clarify a little bit what the public purpose was behind that preference. I'm thinking if the purpose that that the corporation is thinking of is to try to give a preference to, you know, local governments that have sites that they own that they have been trying to get funded for a while, which I think is what the local government area of opportunity is for, then that the 5 points that you mentioned in Section 1B for, you know, the leases or the deeds with local governments, that that should be enough of an advantage already. I feel like otherwise this is kind of creating, you know, some opportunity for monopolies of certain jurisdictions to happen with certain developers or just developers that submit their own separate private sites to have these local government contributions to continue having this kind of monopoly instead of it being more of a public for the local government's benefit. So just wanted to see what your take was on that.
Sure. I think that the point of the local government area of opportunity funding goal, at least as we see it now in both the large and the medium counties in which local governments can participate, is that there truly is a buy-in. I mean, that's literally and figuratively from the local government. So they have a vision for what they want to see and invest in for affordable housing in their community, and we really see that executed at a high level in our the large six RFA, where that has been the funding, the goal for a number of years now. or a focus for a number of years. And when we implemented this goal in the medium county RFA, I mean, we've done a lot of education and communication with local governments, many of who I'm sure are on the line now. And what we've seen and heard is a mixed bag of those local governments who may have the financing but haven't been able to fully flesh out what they want to see and are just having, you know, there's developers knocking on their door saying, sign the form, we'll do great, it'll be great. And of course, I don't mean to, you know, I speak pejoratively that way, but I'm just trying to get the point across is that there is many levels of how local governments are dealing with this. And so what we want to be able to do is incentivize those local governments who have learned through the process, are committed to, it might not be property that they own, so it doesn't to me particularly relate back to the site control discussion, but they're committed to this and they're committed to the proposed development that they envision as a part of their community, and that they have a shot of coming back and getting awarded again. And if they don't, you know, they're not okay with either their, you know, any part of that, they can choose to do something differently with their local government contribution. But what the policy is that we're looking to achieve there is, you know, having a space for those local those applications that have local government contribution participation that has been maintained over time. And so this might not be the perfect way to do it, but we think there's value in that, particularly with regard to the pool of, you know, the large pool of applications in the medium county RFA overall. So so that's what we're trying to achieve there and look at. And also, you know, beef up and make abundantly clear in our requirements for that goal that there also isn't any there's no kickbacks related to that goal. So it, you know, they have a development or a relationship, just making it clear that the contribution can't come from the developer at any point in time, that it's the local government's contribution that is the permanent source of financing for the proposed development. So that's another piece we'll be talking through as well, but that's just a little bit more of an insight about that.
I understand where you're coming from, although I do hear what you're saying, where different jurisdictions vary greatly in the procedures that sometimes they use to determine, you know, what site they believe is the best site for an affordable development. And I think that it is in that variation that there's some room for whether what you're saying can happen or whether that can be kind of twisted into something different. And I mean, I think that is all that I wanted to kind of bring to your attention if you haven't really considered it. But for example, there's counties that have a very defined system, you know, even a scoring system similar to what you guys use to kind of show that they are supporting a site that is the best for affordable housing, as opposed to maybe others that don't really have a procedure and it's more a relationship-based or other type of based system. So that's it, just for consideration. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next one is Oscar Sol. Please go ahead.
Hi. I want to comment again on this, the LGAO preference for previously submitted applications. I think I kind of echo the comments, but I would just make the point that I think what you want is more participation from local governments, but the way you've proposed it here, it would basically cause less participation, because if you're not already in the system, basically, then what incentive would you have for trying to set aside more money for affordable housing to basically get into the system? So I do think that's worth considering. I totally get your point, but I think there might be some other ways to accomplish that. But don't kind of create a barrier to entry for local governments to participate in that process. I just want to go really quickly back.
Yep.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Just want to go back real quick to the comment about the deed. It sounds like you're going to revisit that entirely, but I just want to make this point. If you do end up leaving a requirement or points for a deed, just consider this. Deeds, oftentimes when developers buy property, they don't typically buy these properties with an applicant entity in mind. They might buy it through a holding company. Sometimes a principal would buy the land. So I think one thing, and there's also a way to kind of get an end around to that, which is if a private person owns a piece of property, you could just make them, you can basically make them a principal of your application. Now suddenly now it's like, well, here's the deed. So I think you want to kind of avoid that. What I would consider there is if you are going to keep the deed concept, make it so that the deed is held by some kind of common ownership with the experienced principal of the applicant. That way you're going to avoid basically just making any landowner a partner in the deal, and suddenly now like you get those points. Like that's just too easy to game the system that way. Thanks.
Appreciate it. And I just wanted to follow up on the first comment that you had, which is a fair one about if we even if we moved away from preference but to a specific number of previously submitted LGAO apps to goal out, it may be something that we consider, three of those are that type of LGAO application and two are new, not previously submitted, or something like that. But I just wanted to speak to that because I can understand what you're saying from that perspective. Operator, how many more calls do we have in the queue?
We have one.
Okay, we'll just take this last one then, and then we will conclude things.
All right, the next is Ken Naylor.
Hey, I'll be quick. I wanted to echo Francisco Rojo's comments on the City of Miami and the urban center goal. I think it's wasn't intentional on Florida Housing's part to exclude the most populous city in Miami-Dade County from that goal. And I think if you added some criteria to the goal to allow sites that are very close to transit or very close to jobs into the mix, that would meet the same criteria. I also wanted to point out that Miami-Dade County is doing a lot of RAD redevelopment of public housing planned. They've awarded two of those sites so far. They've got another RFP that they're about to come out with five more sites. A lot of those sites don't meet any of these goals, and I don't think that would, I don't think Florida Housing would want to have a conflict between public housing redevelopment and the goals. So I would recommend that you consider allowing RAD redevelopments to qualify for the Family Area of Opportunity goal, because they're pretty important developments and deserve a place in the system. Thanks
for that feedback, Ken. Thanks everyone for really, that was a long call, but we got a lot out of that I can say I certainly have, and on behalf of the other folks from Florida Housing, I believe they would agree with me that we find the feedback tremendously helpful. And I, in my, while not long, tenure in multifamily with Florida Housing, it's been a few years now, and have not received as robust and thoughtful plentiful public comments for items that we're putting out now. So we really appreciate it. We're trying to speak to it. Hopefully you've been able to see that. We've been in real time making some changes, some updates, and there's some things we are going to stick to, but we certainly value all of your experience and opinions as our partners in this financing structure we have. So I just wanted to thank everybody and thank you for participating on the phone lines as well. And with that will conclude our final large RFA workshop, and look forward to getting the notifications out to you all as the individual RFA workshops are scheduled. And with that, operator, we can conclude the call. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Everyone, that concludes your conference call for today. You may now disconnect. Thank you for joining, and enjoy the rest of your day.